Chapter 16, Becoming Doctors, Sam.
My stomach twisted into a pretzel as I waited to meet with the medical school dean to learn the results of my first state board exam. All medical students take the exam at the end of our second year, and the results determine whether we can move on to the next phase, working 8-week rotations in different areas of medicine at hospitals affiliated with the university. The results hadn't arrived by the beginning of the next semester, so Ramik and I had moved to Camden and started our clinical rotations at Cooper Hospital, adjacent to the South Jersey branch of Robert Wood Johnson. Dr. Mayna, dean of the branch, had received the results first and made appointments with each of us to break the news. He didn't waste any time. "We didn't make it," he said sympathetically. His words knocked the wind out of me. "But it's not a problem," he continued, quickly trying to make it better. "We're going to get you past this. I guarantee you, you'll be fine." I had missed the mark by just a couple of points, but that didn't matter. For a few seconds, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't speak. I couldn't see how I would ever get past this. I had used review books and practice tests and had regularly stayed up studying all night. Everything I had worked for the past 6 years, had come down to this one exam. The night before, I had been unable to sleep. On test day, I had trouble concentrating. Exhaustion had shut down my brain like a computer virus, scrambling or wiping out everything I had learned. When I walked out of the classroom after finishing, I knew I had failed. I had been just hoping I was wrong. Dr. Mayna was genuinely warm and encouraging as he broke the news. "He still believed in me," he said, "but I had to suspend my clinical rotations for 6 weeks to prepare to retake the exam." When I walked into my apartment that evening, Camille, who had moved in with Ramika and me when we relocated to Camden, was standing in the kitchen. When she saw my face, she knew something was wrong. I told her I didn't make it. She rushed over, embraced me, and began to cry. I was still too stunned to cry. Ramik came out of his bedroom and joined us. He knew immediately what was wrong. "Aw, dog, I'm sorry," he said. "But don't worry, it's going to be all right." They had met with Dr. Mayna, too. They didn't even have to tell me they had passed. When I told George about my results over the telephone that evening, he drove all the way from Newark just to sit with me. Guys don't like to make each other uncomfortable, so we didn't really talk about it. He just wanted to be there. The three of us had always been successful together, so this was awkward for us. Neither of them knew what to say to me. The truth is, there was nothing much they could say to make it better. I had to get through this on my own. "Whenever you need me, dog, I'm here," Ramik told me constantly. In college, he and I had always talked through our problems or shared what we were going through during long conversations at night. But this was different. I needed all my energy just to survive each day. I felt like a complete failure, like a boxer who had gotten knocked out in the first round of an important fight by an intimidating opponent he had to face again in just a few weeks. Medical school had not been a nurturing, supportive environment, and from the beginning, I had felt that I didn't belong. Failing the board exam only heightened my sense of isolation. I had no confidence in myself. There was no joy in waking up each morning. As close as Ramik, George, and I were, I wasn't sure even they could relate. George called regularly and occasionally drove to Camden to check on me, and Ramik and I still played basketball together. But there were long periods of silence when we got together. For whatever reasons, my two best friends weren't able to reach me. Camille was the one who broke through. She had struggled in her first 2 years of medical school and knew exactly what I was feeling. I had been her backbone during that difficult time, and she became mine. We often hung out just to talk. She became my sister. We were able to connect on an emotional level that feels too awkward between guys. "You might not understand it now," she said, "but God allowed this to happen for a reason." Alone in my room, I listened to Tupac. He rapped about the pull between his old life as a thug and a new one as a rich rapper. I related to his isolation. But as defeated as I felt, I never stopped pushing myself. Every morning, I got up early, as though I was still going to the hospital. Instead, I went to the library. I studied review books in every subject, including surgery, anatomy, microbiology, cell biology, histology, and physiology. Periodically, I tested myself with practice questions. Sometimes, I teamed up with a fellow student named Terry Rollins, a super smart guy from Atlantic City, to go over questions and concepts. I brought my lunch and took a scheduled break to eat. In the evenings, I studied with two girls who had also failed. We had hung together before at school, and now we bonded and worked to help one another through. They were roommates, so their apartment became our study hall. They often cooked dinner, and I went jogging through their complex, listening to Tupac's Me Against the World and Machiavelli. Then we spread our books across the table or floor and spent the rest of the night studying. To lighten the moment, we told stories to make each other laugh. God knows I needed to laugh. I also traveled to Washington, D.C. to hang out with our former roommate, Dax, who was attending law school at George Washington University. The change of scenery was refreshing. One of the best things I did for myself was to seek counseling from advisors I had come to trust, mainly Carla Dixon and Dr. Young, head of multicultural affairs at the Piscataway campus of Robert Wood Johnson. I didn't tell Ramiko George. I needed to understand why I had failed and what I was supposed to learn from it. I also sought to understand my purpose in medicine. I had reached that point in life where I asked, what is my purpose? What role do I play? Where do I belong? My counselors suggested that I find a way to relieve some of the stress. I began meditating each morning the way Reggie had taught me during Kung Fu lessons a decade earlier, and I worked out during my lunch break. I came to understand I had defeated myself mentally even before I took the exam. In my mind, the exam had become insurmountable. I had to change my thoughts. During meditation, I reminded myself that I was smart enough to pass this exam, and I tried to regain my inner peace. I had focused on clearing my mind, just relaxing, and focusing on the rewards that life had brought me thus far. I wasn't happy, but I had to make the best of the situation. When test time rolled around again, I went to bed early the night before. On the morning of the test, I tried to stay calm. I can do this, I kept repeating in my head. Answers to the test questions flowed more freely. Before I was even halfway done, I knew I would pass. When I went to Dr. Maynard's office to get the results this time, his smile told me what I wanted to hear. I had passed. Thank God, I could move on. I resumed my clinical rotations, but the feeling of sheer elation didn't last long. I continued to feel out of place, especially when my peers talked about the invitations they received to play golf with residents at the hospital or to have dinner at the home of the head doctor. I was never included. But no matter how uncertain I felt about becoming a doctor, I knew that returning home to my old life was not an option. Seeing an old friend again one day reminded me of that. It was summertime, and I was visiting my mother at home. Whenever my old friends saw my car parked outside, they would stand in front of my house underneath my bedroom window and yell, "Yo, Marshall!" until I came out. Every day, I walked over to the project to visit Will, Nudie, and my other friends. There, one day I encountered one of the guys who had participated with me in the robbery. At 15, he had been the youngest in the group. When I saw him again, he was in his early 20s and had just been released from jail after serving time for another crime. We hugged each other the way guys do. "Man, I ain't seen you in a long time," he began. "You don't stay down here no more, huh?" "Nah, man, I just been doing this school thing," I said. "How long did you did?" he asked. He figured I was still out there banging and had spent some time in jail. In our neighborhoods, you don't just walk away from the streets. You keep hustling until you either get too old or too sick or until you get knocked. "Come on, man, that ain't me," I responded, trying to be vague. Staying vague kept them guessing and protected you. "Well, hey, don't get caught up out here. Let's get together and catch up." "Cool," I said. He wished me well and we parted ways. We never got together, and I knew we never would. I was a different person now. I spent my third year working 8-week rotations in pediatrics, surgery, psychiatry, internal medicine, family practice, and obstetrics gynecology at Cooper Hospital. As students, we mostly shadowed residents and the head doctor lectured us once a week. I made high passes in most of my courses in my third year and passed the second state board exam the following summer with no problems. My academic performance was just as good in my fourth year. During the fourth year, each medical student got to choose an area specialty and work a rotation either at Cooper Hospital, which is next to the Camden branch of the medical school, or out of town. I decided to give it a go at another hospital. The six disciplines I had studied in my third year had not intrigued me, but I wanted to try emergency medicine. I chose Hahnemann Medical College of Philadelphia. I had heard that it had a good training program in the field, and I figured I could gather the practical experience to determine whether I wanted to pursue emergency medicine. I drove 40 minutes each way daily for 2 weeks that summer to a small community hospital affiliated with the university. The head doctor, Dr. Carol Hart, made me feel like part of the emergency room team as we evaluated patients and determined the appropriate treatments. This was the first time in all 4 years of medical school that something had felt right to me. Ramik and I decided to go to Atlanta to explore the program at Emory University. One of our friends, Jerry Fillmore, had done a rotation the year before and was now a first-year resident in emergency medicine. The two of us were stationed for 4 weeks at Grady Hospital, a large medical center that serves mostly city dwellers. We stayed in an apartment building owned by the hospital. I worked in the emergency room, and Ramik worked in gastrointestinal medicine. The size of the hospital alone was intimidating, but I caught on to the fast-paced rhythm pretty quickly. I liked the variety of problems we treated, from simple muscle strains to heart attacks, from minor lacerations to gunshot wounds. The work required an ability to think quickly in developing strategies for medical treatments and interventions, and I excelled at that. I've always been good working with my hands. This was what I was waiting for. When the time came to apply for a residency, I decided to pursue emergency medicine. But I started the process late because I was still trying to decide whether that was truly what I wanted to do. About 16,000 medical students throughout the country apply for residencies each year through the Washington, D.C.-based National Resident Matching Program, which uses a computerized database to match students with teaching hospitals. Students do research to find hospitals with their specialties, apply for those positions, and then rank their top choices in a computerized database. In the end, the hospitals list their student choices in the database, and a computer sorts the matches. During an annual event called Match Day, medical students throughout the country learn simultaneously where they will spend the next year as a resident. An internet website helped me identify the hospitals that had slots in emergency medicine, and I applied to about 40 of them. I was invited for interviews at hospitals in New York, Chicago, Baltimore, Atlanta, and Cleveland, and spent about $2,000 traveling to those cities. But I didn't realize that emergency medicine was so competitive. 2 days before match day, the dean called me into his office for more bad news. I had not matched in emergency medicine. None of my top choices of hospitals had listed me among their top choices of students. The dean gave me a list of hospitals that still had residency positions available in various disciplines. Most of my classmates had matched at hospitals on their list and would find out on match day where they would be going. But along with other students who had not matched, I spent an entire day on the telephone scrambling to find a position. I knew Ramik had listed the University of Maryland as his first or second choice and Robert Wood Johnson Hospital as the other. He had kept changing the order of his top two picks until the deadline arrived for submitting our list. The University of Maryland still had a residency slot available, but the position was in internal medicine. I called, and the resident coordinator asked me to submit my application via the computer. The program there was reputable, but I had no interest in internal medicine. Time was running out, though. If I didn't find a slot, I would have to wait another year to reapply. The day before match day, I was offered a slot at University of Maryland. Just before noon on March 18, 1999, I met with my peers in a lecture hall at the hospital for match day ceremony. Dozens of bottles of champagne were lined up across the stage. Each student was handed a sealed envelope bearing the code that the computer had used to match us. At exactly noon, the dean instructed us to open our envelopes. Medical students across the country were opening their envelopes at the same time. Ramik and I ripped open our envelopes. He had matched at his top choice, Robert Wood Johnson Hospital. I was happy for him, but disappointed. I already knew what was inside my envelope. Since Ramik would not be going to the University of Maryland, I would have to go there alone. The room quickly filled with streaks of excitement. Students hugged each other and rushed around the room to find out where their colleagues had matched. I stood back and observed quietly. I was in no mood to celebrate. I again felt disappointed. I had no idea, and still don't, why I had not matched in emergency medicine. I had the grades. Maybe I had begun the process too late. Or maybe it was my lack of comfort doing interviews at the hospitals. All I knew was that the match process, like everything else in medical school, had come as a surprise. I had heard about it for the first time just before it was time for me to go through it. No one had ever sat me down and explained step by step what to expect in medical school. I was always finding out about courses and events the day of the deadline or just days before, which left little time to develop a strategy for success or even to prepare myself mentally. I signed a letter of intent committing myself as a resident at the University of Maryland. I knew immediately that I had made a big mistake. I was tired of fighting. I couldn't understand why everything had been such a struggle for me. I told myself that I had fulfilled the pact. I had finished college and was near completing medical school with George and Ramik. But graduation would be the end of this road for me. I had never promised my friends that I would actually practice medicine. Maybe I would be happier doing something else. After trying so hard and giving so much, I at least deserved to be happy. Business still interested me, so I thought that perhaps I could use my medical background to find a position with a medical insurance company or health maintenance organization. I also considered enrolling in business school to earn an MBA. I called the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia and requested an application. I wasn't sure how George and Ramik would react, so I decided not to tell them right away. I did, however, tell a friend from college named Patrick, who lived in South Jersey, and he said that his mother, the chief executive officer of a drug rehabilitation center in Atlantic City, might be able to help me. I called her, and she promised to put me in touch with the head of a preferred physicians organization there. The next time I talked to her, she had arranged an interview for me in Atlantic City. I drove 45 minutes to Atlantic City, and the two of us had lunch with the PPO executive. It did not take them long to figure out that I was suffering from burnout. The executive showed me around his company, but both he and my friend's mother tried to encourage me to go ahead with my residency. They said it would be a mistake to quit before getting a feel for what medicine was really like. I spent one day in Atlantic City. Before I left, the executive offered me a job as a billing manager, making about $30,000 a year, a position I think he knew that I would turn down. Still, I wasn't persuaded to take a residency that I did not want. In April, just weeks before graduation, I called Carla Dixon. I met her at Seton Hall for lunch one spring afternoon. After lunch, we went to a park and sat on a bench to talk. She knew what I had gone through in medical school. This was it, I told her. I was done with medicine. The sadness in my eyes told her that I was serious. For the first time, she did not have an answer. After a few seconds, she said, "If you don't want to go to University of Maryland, just call the representative and tell her you're not coming." "But is that the right thing to do?" I asked. I was afraid to back out of the University of Maryland position because I had signed a letter of intent. The match process is practically as binding as the NBA draft. It was almost unheard of to back out of a match after signing a letter of intent. When I had complained about not wanting to go, my professors and colleagues had warned me not to change my mind. It could wreck my career, they said, and further, I could be held legally liable. But what Carla said next brought clarity. "This is your life, Sam," she said. "You have to do what's best for Sam. What does Sam really want to do?" I knew then I was not going to take the slot in Maryland. But there was still a part of me that did not want to give up on emergency medicine, a part of me that didn't want to be defeated. The next week, I decided to search the internet to find out how many emergency medicine programs there were in New Jersey. I was shocked by what I found. Beth Israel Hospital in Newark had a program in emergency medicine. The hospital hadn't been listed among the programs I found when I did my initial computer search before the match process. The computer was now showing that all of the hospital's resident positions had been filled. I decided to take a long shot and call the hospital anyway. I took a deep breath, picked up the telephone, and called Jackie Johnson, the resident coordinator there. I hit the lottery. She said the hospital had expanded its residency slots that year and had not filled all of them. She asked me to send my application. A few days later, I was invited to the hospital for an interview. I can't describe how comfortable I felt when I walked through those doors. I felt immediately that I was home, that was where I belonged. I reminded myself to stay calm and answer the interview questions from my heart. I felt surprisingly at ease and connected to the doctors interviewing me. When the interview was finished, I knew things had gone well. I was invited for a second interview. Then, the resident director called and offered me the slot. I wanted to accept right away, but first I had to notify the University of Maryland that I would not be coming. I still anguished over making that telephone call and had kept putting it off. Finally, I called. I explained that my heart was set on working in emergency medicine, and I would not be happy there. I shared how difficult the decision to back out of the agreement had been for me. When I finished talking, I expected the worst, maybe even the threat of a lawsuit. Instead, the woman on the other end was understanding. She said the university did not want me there if I would not be happy, and she wished me well. The fear and frustration I had felt for weeks slid off my shoulders. Something mystical, I believe the power of God, was at work here. I was about to return as a doctor to the same hospital where I was born. I was going back home.
Perseverance, Sam.
Medical school was one of the roughest periods of my life. Something unexpected was always threatened to knock me out of the game. Family distractions, the results of my first state board exam, the outcome of my initial search for a residency. But through determination, discipline, and dedication, I was able to persevere. I call them my 3 D's, and I believe that they are the perfect formula for survival, no matter what you are going through. Determination is simply fixing your mind on a desired outcome, and I believe it is the first step to a successful end in practically any situation. When I made the pact with George and Ramik at the age of 17, I was desperate to change my life. Going to college and medical school with my friends seemed the best way to make that happen. But of course, I had no idea of the challenges awaiting me, and many times over the years, I felt like giving up. Trust me, even the most dedicated person can get weary when setbacks halt or interfere with your progress. But determination means nothing without the discipline to go through the steps necessary to reach your goal, whether you're trying to lose weight or finish college, and the dedication to stick with it. When I failed the state board exam, the light in the tunnel disappeared, but I just kept crawling toward my goal. I sought counseling when I needed it, and I found at least one person with whom I could share the range of emotions I was experiencing. If you're going through a difficult time and can't see your way out alone, you should consider asking for help. I know how difficult that is for most guys. We're raised to believe that it's a sign of weakness even to display emotions, let alone ask for help. But reaching out to counselors I had come to trust over the years and talking to my roommate Camille helped me unload some of the weight I was carrying. Only then was I able to focus clearly on what I needed to do to change my circumstances. I'm grateful that I took Kung Fu lessons as a kid because the discipline I learned back then really helped me to stay consistent once I started meditating, working out, and studying every single day. It wasn't easy, but those were the steps required to get where I wanted to be. Concentrating on getting through each day kept me from feeling overwhelmed, and reflection helped me to see that I had overcome tremendous barriers. In the beginning, during a trying adolescence, I felt as if I was a good kid caught up in a bad situation and truly had to work diligently to overcome struggles. You can't choose the circumstances that you're born in. However, you can use your insight and hunger to push forward. Life's challenges helped me to maintain my focus and remain humble. Family matters, my brother's injury, my sister's diagnosis, my mother's financial struggles back home, sometimes competed for my full attention. There's no one-size-fits-all way to handle family issues. Everybody's families and circumstances are different. But I realized that to remain focused on my goal, I couldn't focus so much on my family, especially when the energy I expended worrying about them didn't change a thing. Another important ingredient of perseverance is surrounding yourself with friends who support your endeavor. I can't tell you how much it helped me to have George and Ramik in my life to help me reach my goal. Even though things were awkward between us for a while after I failed the state boards, just knowing they were there and that they expected me to succeed motivated me. I found motivation wherever I could. One of my college professors once told me that I didn't have what it takes to be a doctor. I even used that to motivate me. I love being the underdog. I love it when someone expects me to fail. That, like nothing else, can ignite my 3 D's. And when success comes, I'm the one who's not surprised. My motto is simple. No one can tell me that I can't succeed. I've come to believe that every goal in life is obtainable and that the only limitations are the ones you set for yourself. For some, the road to success is merely based on taking advantage of opportunities provided to them. For others, the road is much more difficult because they have to create opportunities for themselves. When you have to find a way where there seems to be none, as I sometimes had to do, success in the end is even sweeter. I had to keep getting up when life knocked me down. There's nothing sweeter than stealing victory from the jaws of defeat. The closest I ever came to giving up was when I did not match at any of the hospitals I had listed. But again, something on the inside would not let me quit. And my last try on the internet brought amazing results. That's how life is sometimes. When you fail repeatedly and think you're done, that last try, the one that requires every ounce of will and strength you have, is often one to pull you through.
Chapter 17, Graduation, George.
For a while, it seemed that both Sam and I would land in Maryland for our residencies. I was considering joining the U.S. Air Force as a dentist, and I expected to be stationed at Andrews Air Force Base, about an hour down the road from Baltimore. The Air Force was offering a $30,000 one-time signing bonus, not including salary and benefits, to entice recruits to its medical corps. The money caught my attention. An Air Force van picked up several classmates and me and drove us to Maryland to tour Andrews in our senior year of dental school. We walked through Air Force Two, the Vice President's plane, and saw Air Force One, the President's plane, up close. But I changed my mind about joining the military. I had just spent a grueling 8 years in college and dental school, and I realized that I didn't want to face the rigors of boot camp or the everyday restrictions of military life. I could have graduated from dental school and gone to work right away as a dentist. A dentist isn't required to do a residency, but I figured a residency would give me the practical experience I needed and make me more competitive. I learned that there was an opening in dentistry for a general practice resident at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey in Newark, the same place that had first inspired my dream to become a dentist. I talked to Zia Shea, associate dean of the dental school, and expressed an interest. I interviewed and was offered the position. About the same time, Ramik and Sam told me they had accepted their residencies in the Newark area, Sam at Beth Israel Medical Center and Ramik at Robert Wood Johnson. We would end up at home together. It had never occurred to me that our graduation ceremonies would be at the same time. One day, near the end of my last semester in dental school, I asked them the dates and places of their graduations. When they told me that their ceremonies were set for May 26 at the PNC Bank Art Center in Homedale, I realized that there would be one ceremony for the entire University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey system. We would graduate together. Ramik and I decided to invite some of our favorite teachers and counselors from University High School to our graduation. One of the staff members we invited was Dr. Valerie Noble, a guidance counselor who had encouraged us in high school. We often went to our guidance counselors when we needed to talk about a personal problem or had career questions, and they were always helpful. Dr. Noble was extremely proud that Ramik, Sam, and I had remained friends and were now about to graduate from medical school. Knowing our backgrounds, she said she couldn't stop thinking about what an extraordinary accomplishment we had achieved. In the days before graduation, she told a reporter she knew about us. When Dr. Noble called and told us that the local paper was interested in writing a story about us, I was more puzzled than excited. I didn't understand what the big deal was. Hundreds of students were graduating from medical school that day, but we agreed to be interviewed. We met with a reporter before graduation. It was a beautiful sunny morning, and we arrived in our black caps and gowns and colorful hoods. My mother, my father, my grandmother, and most of my aunts and uncles, as well as my childhood friends, Naeem and Abdul, Shahid Jackson and his father and brother, were all there. When I saw my Aunt Lestine Graves, I was reminded how much her achievements had inspired me. Aunt Lestine had been in her early 40s when she returned to college in Maryland about the same time I entered Seton Hall. Then, a mother of two teenagers, she consistently ranked at the top of her class. Many times when I struggled with the class, I thought about how tough it must have been for her to juggle school and family. Yet she consistently outperformed her younger peers, most of whom had the luxury of concentrating solely on school. "You know what? I can do it too," I said to myself. The graduates sat in large groups divided by schools. Because we were seated in alphabetical order, I sat next to the other guys whose names began with J. Guys I had sat next to for 4 years during my major exams and classes that grouped us that way. We talked and goofed off for most of the ceremony. Finally, it was time to receive our degrees. The Master of Ceremonies first called the Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine, and the graduates all stood and moved toward the stage. One by one, their names were called. Then, Dr. Sampson Davis. As I watched Sam walk across the stage, I sat still and quiet. Pride swirled through my body. I was thinking, man, we really did this. I thought of all we had been through together, from boys comparing sneakers on the schoolyard in junior high to men walking across the stage to become doctors. We had leapt into the unknown together and locked hands and pulled each other up, over, and through the rough spots. I remembered how much I had hurt for him when he had failed the state board exam for the first time. How I had driven to Camden 1.5 hours each way nearly every weekend after that to be there for him. I tried to get him to play basketball and just have some fun to get his mind off the results of that test. It was all I could do to show him that I cared and that he wasn't alone. This was the fourth time Sam and I had graduated together. Junior high, high school, college, and now medical and dental school. Just before graduation, Ramik had placed so much faith in me that he became one of my first patients. He needed some dental work done, and instead of going to an established professional, he visited the clinic at the dental school about 5 different times so that I could fill a few of his teeth. I even performed periodontal surgery on him. The credits I earned working on my boy helped me to graduate. Sam, Ramik, and I had become brothers, accepting each other for who we were. Our relationship extended to our families. During medical school, Ramik lived with my aunt in Maryland rent-free so he could do a rotation at Howard University. I didn't really feel proud of myself until I saw Sam and Ramik walk across the platform. I thought of all I had learned from them. Sam, the workhorse, the most doggedly determined person I'd ever met, who held so much inside, and Ramik, the skeptic and activist, who was outraged by injustice and always believed there was something he could do to make things right. I like to think I brought foresight to our trio. I've always been able to think clearly and see through to the end of a situation before getting entangled in it. That saved our behinds 1,000,000 times. When Ramik, Sam, and I each crossed the stage to get our diplomas, our families and friends roared. Each of us had an entourage of at least 20 people sitting in every corner of the amphitheater. Afterward, classmates jokingly asked if we had hired cheering squads. After graduation, Sam, Ramik, and I decided not to go out together. We had planned our first real vacation together, and we were leaving for Cancun the next morning. It was our treat for all of the spring breaks and summer vacations we had missed because we'd been studying or working, and for all of the trips our families couldn't afford to take while we were kids growing up in Newark. I did, however, go to visit my father, who had arrived in town 2 days before my graduation. I had been so busy that I hadn't had time to see him. A couple of my friends went with me to his hotel room. All of us had a few drinks together and caught up. I shared with him what was going on in my life, and he talked a bit about his. Nothing really deep. This was the way things were between my father and me. I had long ago accepted that. Before I left, he told me he was proud of me. An hour had passed. It was time for me to get home. Early the next morning, I drove around the corner to get a newspaper from one of the street salesmen. I knew the story on us was scheduled to appear, but I didn't know on what page. I stuck my hand out of the car window and motioned for the newspaper salesman. He turned to walk toward me, and I could see the front page atop the stack of papers and the plastic vest he was wearing. As he got closer, the photo of 3 boys drew more sharply into focus. They were grade school pictures of Ramik, Sam, and me. We were on the front page. I was blown away. Most of the time when I saw young black men on the front page of a newspaper, they had either committed a big crime or they were dead. Not this day, though. Our childhood photos were atop a larger photo of us congratulating each other after graduation. The story underneath told all of Newark about our pact. I had no idea then that the headline would be prophetic. It read simply, "Start of Something Big."
Chapter 18. Goodbye, Ramik.
Ma always talked about retiring and moving to South Carolina. Soon after I began medical school, she did just that. After having worked as a mail clerk at the Newark Post Office for 28 years, She bought a beautiful three-bedroom house that sat on a cul-de-sac in a secluded neighborhood in Columbia, the state capital. She liked the slow pace and the beauty of the area. Ma initially planned to sell the family house in Plainfield, but she decided to keep it when the offers were lower than expected. She also wanted to have a place for her children to go if any of them ever needed a place to stay. It seemed that Ma would finally get to relax and enjoy the rest of her life. She had worked hard for so long, but in 1997, the family noticed that she didn't look well when she returned home to visit her youngest daughter, Nicole, who had just had a baby. Ma's stomach was swollen as though she was pregnant. Her skin had darkened, and the whites of her eyes had a yellowish tint. My aunt urged her to see a doctor. About 2 months later, Ma called and told Nicole that her doctor had diagnosed her with cirrhosis of the liver. The family kept it from me. By the time I found out, Ma was so sick that my Uncle Sheldon, a school teacher in New York, was heading to Columbia for the summer to help take care of her. "Something's wrong with her liver," my aunt said when she called to tell me. My family often hid bad news from me while I was away at school. They didn't want me to worry. When I first heard about Ma, I didn't get alarmed because she had bounced back quickly before when a chest aneurysm forced her early retirement from the post office. It was the only other time I had ever seen her sick. But this time, Ma kept getting sicker. When it was time for my uncle to return to New York to go back to work, the family realized that Ma couldn't stay in South Carolina alone. She needed to come back to Plainfield to be closer to the family. At first, she resisted, but reality forced her to give in. When Ma moved back home, she didn't look like herself. She had lost so much weight that she was skinny. Her skin was so dry and scaly that she scratched all the time. But even on her sickest day, I never saw her break down or cry. "Don't worry about me," she always said. But I did worry. Ma was slipping away, and I knew it. Nothing in life had prepared me to lose the woman who had been as close as a mother to me. I lived 1.5 hours away, but I drove to Plainfield as often as I could to visit her. In my last year of medical school, Ma's liver began to fail. For months, she was transferred from one hospital to the next for treatment. She landed at Mount Sinai in Manhattan. Once, the doctors had to intubate her. I rushed to her bedside. She couldn't speak, but I sat next to her, stroked her hand, and assured her that everything would be all right. I had seen many patients this way, but now it was personal. Seeing my grandmother so uncomfortable helped me to be more sensitive to patients I encountered in medical school during my clinical rotations. I even chose gastroenterology as a specialty because I wanted to understand what was going on with my grandmother and someday keep others from suffering as much as she suffered. Doctors were unsure what had caused this cirrhosis. The family turned to me with their questions. I felt helpless. I was a medical student, not a seasoned specialist, and I didn't have any answers. Her doctor seemed to be guessing about the cause of her illness. When I told him that Ma was not a heavy drinker, he said that even an occasional binge on alcohol could have caused the problem. I was offended by the suggestion. Only two things were certain. Ma needed a new liver soon, and if she didn't get one, she would die. The hospital placed her on a list of people waiting for liver transplants, but the doctor explained that because the wait could be as long as a year, she would probably not live to get a new liver. The doctor also presented us with a riskier alternative. The diseased part of Ma's liver could be replaced with a piece of a healthy liver from a living donor. I volunteered immediately to be tested as a possible match. I was scared, but I loved my grandmother. I figured I was young and healthy and could rebound quickly after the surgery. I talked to George and Sam about my decision. "Do what you gotta do, dog," they told me. "We'll be there for you." I was prepared to go forward with the testing for the procedure, but my mother, aunts, and uncles talked me out of it. They said they needed me to be healthy to communicate with the doctors and didn't want to put me at risk. Most of the other family members who were willing to be tested had been ruled out as potential donors by the hospital's list of criteria, so we prayed and waited for a donor to be found elsewhere. Ma's illness proved to be a trying time for our family. When she could no longer take care of herself, the finger-pointing began about who wasn't doing enough to help. Ma had always been the one who solved problems and brought calm. Without her mediation, matters often dissolved into chaos. My aunts and uncles sometimes went without speaking until the next crisis brought them together. Through it all, Ma never stopped encouraging me. "I'm so proud of you," she would say. "You're doing so good." My graduation was approaching, and I prayed that Mom would be able to make it. I wanted her to see me walk across the stage and become Dr. Ramik Hunt. I wanted her to witness the miracle that her faith in me had brought. On graduation day, I kept looking into the stands for my family. They had helped me as much as they could have. When I began medical school and couldn't afford the expensive books, my mother's brothers and sisters had pooled money and sent it to me every month for several months. I've always been very grateful to them for that. From my seat near the front of the auditorium, the faces in the crowd looked blurred. But one time as I scanned the room, I noticed someone sitting in a wheelchair in the aisle. I couldn't make out the face, but I knew it was Ma. She had been determined to see this day. When the ceremony ended, my family wheeled her down to greet me. I threw my arms around her. She couldn't have given me a more special gift. About 3 weeks later, the hospital called Mom with good news. A donor for her had been located. She happened to be home alone, but she needed to get to the hospital right away. A liver can function outside the body for only a limited time. Ma called her children. Nicole contacted her husband, Jose, who worked in Plainfield and was just about to leave for the day. He drove to Ma's house and, escorted by Port Authority police, rushed her to Mount Sinai. Other family members met him there and waited in the family room while she underwent the surgery. Doctors had told Jose that the operation was expected to take 6 hours. There was a high risk that Ma could die during the surgery. But when the team of doctors emerged from the operating room 2 hours early, my aunts and uncles took that as a good sign. They were right. The surgery was a success. When I heard the good news, I felt hopeful for the first time in months that she would get better. Ma's recovery was going so well that the doctor released her from the hospital within a week. She began to feel stronger and look healthier, but that lasted just a few days. On June 19th, 1999, the day before the family was scheduled to gather at a cookout in West Orange to celebrate my graduation, Ma developed a fever and had to return to the hospital. We didn't think it was serious because she had experienced a similar episode a couple of days earlier and the fever had gone away. The weather for the cookout was perfect, sunny and hot. A large crowd of my family and friends, including Sam and George, spent the afternoon eating, drinking, dancing, and playing cards. I kept in touch with the doctor by phone. That night, Sam and I were out on a double date when Ma's doctor called me on my cellular phone. Her blood pressure had dropped to dangerously low levels, and the infection had crept all over her body. I needed to get to the hospital right away. On the way there, I prayed that Mom would be okay, but somehow I knew she wouldn't. When I arrived, family members were crying and hugging each other in the family room just outside the intensive care unit. Mom was gone. In my grief, I needed answers. I needed to know who was to blame. Had the doctor sent Ma home too soon? Was the liver they transplanted infected already? What had gone wrong? I pushed for an autopsy, but my family wouldn't hear of it. That wouldn't bring her back, they said, nor would it erase my pain. It was the hardest thing that I had ever done, but I accepted their decision. I let her go.
Chapter 19, Home Again. Sam.
After graduation, I moved back to Newark into the house of a friend from high school, Mary Ann Jackson. It was a perfect arrangement. The Jacksons lived in a modest, three-level house in a working-class neighborhood just 3.5 miles from Beth Israel. Mary Ann lives in an apartment on the first floor, and I rented a bedroom on the top level next to her cousin, Frankie White. As soon as I moved in, Mary Ann's mother, Carol Jackson, became my second mother and welcomed me into her extended family. She cooked big meals, which were wonderful after long shifts at the hospital. Frankie cooked on the weekends. Alex, a neighbor, and another of Miss Jackson's adopted soldiers stopped by in the evenings to eat and socialize. Miss Jackson and Frankie took great pride in the cooking, and I was more than happy to clean up the leftovers. Though we were back home, in some ways it felt as though everything had changed. None of us could have predicted the kind of reaction that the newspaper story about us would generate. We became every mother's son. Strangers approached us with hugs. One woman walked up to me and burst into tears. We began to get letters from single women, and we got telephone calls at work from church groups and nonprofit organizations that wanted us to tell our story to other young people. Practically everyone saw us as a unit. "You're one of those three doctors," people we encountered on the streets would say. We quickly amassed $3,000 in gifts from speaking engagements, but we did not want to divide the money and just blow it. We figured we could put the money to good use by giving it away as a college scholarship to a needy student. But we decided we could do even more. We could create a nonprofit foundation that would finance ongoing scholarships as well as programs that would expose children living in poor communities to professionals, colleges, and careers. We wanted to do for children in our neighborhoods what we knew would have helped us. We researched and established the Three Doctors Foundation Incorporated. The publicity from the newspaper story had another unexpected effect. Strangers who showed up in the emergency room at Beth Israel began telling the hospital staff that they were related to me. It became a big joke. One time, though, it wasn't funny. 3 months into my residency, I was about to begin my morning shift in the intensive care unit when a nurse approached me. A woman in a room down the hall had come in the night before and was suffering from AIDS-related pneumonia. She claimed to be my sister. I froze. I knew this time it was true. The patient down the hall was my older sister, Felice. For a moment, I didn't know what to do. I had not imagined my professional and personal lives meeting this way. Should I tell everyone that she was my sister and rush to her bedside? How would I be able to maintain a professional demeanor while watching my sister suffer? And what would my colleagues think if they saw me break down? I pushed those thoughts to the back of my mind. I couldn't worry about that now. My big sister needed me. It wouldn't be the last time that Felice or someone else I knew showed up at the hospital during my shift. One time, I barely missed an old friend. Just 3 days before I began a rotation in trauma at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, one of the older guys who had been involved in a robbery with me was rushed to the emergency room with gunshot wounds to his hip and abdomen. Another guy had been quicker to pull the trigger during an argument in the projects. The medical staff operated to remove the bullets, but he died the next day. He had just turned 30. When I heard what happened, I hurt for my old friend and his family. I suddenly saw myself, instead of turning out to be a young doctor, treating guys like him, I could easily have ended up a hustler, lying on a gurney with bullet holes, about to snuff out my life. Incidents like those helped me to grow and find the thing that had eluded me through all 4 years of medical school, my purpose and place as a physician. More times than not, the patients I treat are poor. Sometimes they are drug dealers, addicts, prostitutes, or drunks. I can't look down on them. I have brothers and sisters who suffer from mental conditions and addictions. I had been a thug myself. I realized that the only thing that separates my patients from me is opportunity and the support of family and friends. No matter what state they are in, when they come to me for treatment, I never judge them. "Hey, I know you," I would say with a big smile when a familiar face showed up in the emergency room. "You know I'm going to take care of you." I saw relief in their eyes, and I knew why I needed to be a doctor. I discovered that peace of mind follows purpose. All of the misery and doubt that I had felt over the past 4 years disappeared. In my evaluations, the head doctors said things like, "I never seen a guy so happy to be at work. I've never seen a guy interact as well with the ancillary staff as he does with the head staff. I've never seen another guy who can bring a smile to a patient's face no matter what kind of day he is having." For the first time in years, I was truly happy. I had overcome so much, and there were regular reminders of that. In my second year of residency, I received a subpoena to testify at a rape trial. I had treated the alleged victim in the emergency room and had to testify to her physical condition. As I walked up the courthouse steps that day, it dawned on me that this was the same building where I had met regularly with my probation officer a decade earlier. This time, I was returning as a doctor. During the hearing, I would be deemed an expert witness. Now that I was back home, I got to spend more time with family and old friends from the neighborhood, particularly my boy, Will. William Cortez was one of the first real friends I ever had. He lived across the street from me with his mother and younger brother in Building 6 of the Dayton Street Projects. We met playing SpongeBob in the neighborhood, and before long, the two of us and Nudie and another friend, Jermaine, were hanging together all the time. Like mine, Will's family struggled. On many days, he had to eat at his grandmother's house because there was no food at home. And like me, he was seduced for a short time by the thrills of the street. The day I got involved in an armed robbery, we had stopped by Will's house to pick him up. But he had a new girlfriend, and he told her to tell us he was not there. When I left for college, Will had dropped out of high school and was working in a housekeeping department at a nearby hospital. His girlfriend was pregnant. He was so happy for me when I told him I was going to college. At least somebody gonna do it, he told me. That's what I liked about Will. He was a positive brother who always encouraged me, even during the rough times in medical school when I called him and talked about dropping out. Nah, man, there ain't nothing back here for you, he would tell me. I'm proud of you. You got brothers like me looking up to you. We were cooling out in my room one day before I left for college when he asked me to be his daughter's godfather. My mouth dropped open. I had this expression on my face, like, me? He was my boy, and the gesture meant so much. I was in medical school in January 1995 when Will called and told me he had been shot. He had stopped at a stop sign in his gray and white Oldsmobile Achiever when a car full of guys pulled up next to him and started staring him down. Suddenly, one of the passengers jumped out and started shooting into Will's car. The guy fired at least 10 rounds with a 45, striking Will in the chin near his neck and his front seat passenger in the face and arm. Broken glass from the shattered car window grazed the backseat passenger on the ear. Two of Will's friends, following behind him in another car, were also shot. Unbeknownst to Will, the guy in his back seat, an acquaintance he was given a ride home, had gotten into a beef with the shooter at a bar earlier. He survived the injuries, but for a long time, the shooting made Will leery of meeting new people. But when I introduced Will to Joyce or Amit, the three of them instantly hit it off. Will wasn't the least bit threatened by or jealous of my relationship with the two of them. If anything, he co-signed the friendship pact and became a part of it, once even vacationing with the three of us. George, Ramik, and I kept up ties with some of the more positive brothers from our old neighborhoods, and the other two of us would embrace him as part of our group. Will was at our graduation. He was there many times when the three of us gave speeches in the community or received awards, and he began hanging out with us when the three of us returned to Newark as doctors. One of the most gratifying things to happen when I returned to Newark was my relationship with my oldest brother, Kenny. Kenny, who had been paralyzed on his right side, was living in a residential home for the disabled in a suburb called Cedar Grove. As a kid, I had always admired him, but he was often so mean to me that I wondered whether he loved me. Before his injury, our relationship had been strained, but I began to visit him regularly, and I could feel us getting closer. Every time I went to see him, he had 100 people, doctors, nurses, other staff and patients he wanted me to meet. During one of my visits, just before Christmas in 2000, he casually handed me a plastic bag. "This is your Christmas present," he said. I was surprised. I couldn't remember the last time Kenny had given me a Christmas present. I opened the bag. Inside was a big green leather photo album. A few days later, when I had a little downtime at home, I put out my new photo album to start filling it with pictures. On the cover was something I hadn't noticed: Dr. Sampson Marshall Davis, 1999, in gold press-on letters. He had obviously worked on it during his crafts workshop. I flipped the album open to the first page to start arranging my pictures, but there was another surprise. It read, "Marshall, I admire you, and I am proud of all your accomplishments. The following pages will prove it to you. Love, your brother, Kenny." He had saved and collected old photos, every graduation program and newspaper article that mentioned my name, even my old report cards and diploma from grade school. I'm not one to cry easily, but the tears came faster than I could swallow. It was the best gift I have ever received. Every successful career has defining moments, those times when you know deep down that you're doing what you were meant to do and you're good at it. For me, those moments have been as simple as seeing the gratitude in a patient's eyes, or as grand as watching a patient you fought to save gradually come back to life. Sometimes, though, it is even in the agony of falling short after giving everything you've got. April 19th, 2001, about 9:15 p.m. I was stitching a patient's mouth when I suddenly heard chaos, doors slamming and people shouting and rushing down the hall. I finished and stepped out of the door. "Someone's been shot," I heard in the commotion. I ran outside and saw a young man about my age holding his torso, bent over, stumbling around. Blood covered his shirt and pants. I took his hand and helped the staff put him on a stretcher. We quickly wheeled him into the emergency room. I counted 6 gunshot wounds. I observed his chest and checked his airway to make sure he was breathing normally and there were no airway obstructions. He was alert enough to tell me that he had been standing on a corner when some guys walked up and shot him. "How old are you, man?" I asked, trying to keep him calm as I worked to save his life. 33, he said softly. I ran an intravenous line into his blood vessels to pump fluids into him as quickly as possible. He was losing too much blood. I put a tube down his throat to open his airway, cut a small incision in his chest, and inserted a separate tube to expand his lungs, which had collapsed. He looked up at me. "Doc, I'm going to die," he said. "There's nothing you can do." "Stay with me, man. I'm here." I said, "I'm with you." One thing I had learned in my short career was that when a patient tells you he is going to die, you better listen. My patient closed his eyes, and within minutes, the rhythmic thump of the monitor became a shrill, steady beat. A flat line appeared on the screen. His heart had stopped. We were losing him. "Stay with me, man. Stay with me," I shouted. I immediately began CPR. He didn't respond. Time was running out. A surgeon, who had responded to my page and was standing at the patient's bedside, took over and performed a thoracotomy, a last-minute life-saving procedure in which a patient's chest is opened to evaluate the heart and the major vessels and look for holes in those structures. Sure enough, my colleagues discovered a hole in the ventricle of the heart. By then, our patient was dead. "I'm sorry," I said to his wife and mother at the man's bedside a short while later. "We did everything we could to save him." "You should have done more," the mother yelled at me. She was hurting, and I knew it. I just wish she could have known how much I was hurting, too. I had worked nearly 2 hours to save her son's life, and I had done everything humanly possible to bring him back. I had already asked myself if I could have done more. Still, I would go home and read more, study more, try to improve, and pray that just maybe next time I could help more. That, to me, is what being a doctor is all about. As I left the room, the director of the residency program pulled me aside in the hall. I was in no mood for questions. What did he want? "I just want to congratulate you," he said. I gave him the strangest look. I had just lost a patient and my boss was congratulating me. "You scored very well on an in-service exam, one of the best in the class," he said. He was referring to the exam that residents at hospitals across the country take each year to test their proficiency in their specialties. It is the profession's way of gauging how a resident is doing in the field. My score was above average for the nation. I had risen to the top of the class. Sometime later, Ramit, George, and I got together to celebrate my performance on the test, George's birthday, and all the blessings to that point. We met at a nightclub and ordered drinks. When the drinks arrived, we raised our glasses high. No need for a bunch of corny words. We knew what we had been through. "Two friends," we said, one at a time, clicking our glasses together in a triumphant toast.
Epilogue.
It really makes us feel good when we finish a speech at a school, church, or community center, and kids come up to us in their cliques and say they're going to form their own pact. When the three of us promised in high school to see each other through to become doctors, we had no idea how we'd get through. We honestly didn't even give it much thought. But we realized since then that each of us was successful individually in large part because of our pact. The pact gave us the motivation to keep pushing when it would have been easier to just give up. So we've come up with a few pieces of advice to help others unite with friends to reach short-term or long-term goals. We believe these steps can be useful to the group no matter what the goal is. First, join trustworthy friends who have the same goal. George was the one who put our pact together. Though two of us, Ramik and Sam, initially had different ideas about what we wanted to do after high school, we came around to George's way of thinking before making our promise to one another. Next, find strength in your differences. Friends don't have to be alike to be part of a pact. The three of us all have distinct personalities that we bring to the mix, and that just makes our bond all the more interesting and strong. We draw from one another's strengths, but to be able to keep our promise to one another, we first had to want the same thing. The few times when our promise threatened to break apart was when one of us began to want something different from what the other two wanted. We also had to trust each other completely. We had to believe that we had one another's back, or crazy suspicions of each other's motives might have driven us apart. Next, believe in yourself and your friends. After we graduated from high school, Ramik's younger sister, Daima, ended up with the same biology teacher that he'd had, the one he didn't like. When Daima told the teacher that she was Ramik's sister, the teacher asked whether he had become a bum. "No," Daima said proudly. "He's a doctor." That teacher may not have believed that Ramik was ever going to do anything positive with his life. But all three of us knew he was smart and would find a way to make a positive difference in the world. All three of us had, and still have, that kind of faith in each other. It just doesn't make much sense to hook up with somebody you can't believe in. Next, compete in a healthy way. This is a biggie, because healthy competition pushed each of us to be at the top of our game all the time. Each of us wanted to perform as well as the other two. But understand that healthy competition is just that, healthy, which means there's no room for jealousy. Jealousy would have brought too much negative energy to our group. It would have made us question the trust that is so integral to our friendship and to the very nature of a pact. If any of us ever felt even a bit envious of the others, it never surfaced in a way that was obvious to us. We celebrated one another's successes, and each one of us felt the same hurt when one of our boys failed at something. Next, communicate openly, honestly, and often. This kept us sane. We hung out together and talked every day about what we were going through. We compared notes and gave each other advice and suggestions. Ramik and Sam were roommates for all 8 years, and to be successful at it, they learned to talk out their differences better than many married couples. There were times, though, when we kept things from each other. Times when sharing our feelings was difficult. We blamed that on just being guys. In our case, the stereotype, guys don't share their feelings with each other, was definitely true. If we have any regrets, that's probably chief among them. Our inability to communicate when Sam felt like he was dying inside forced him to look outside the group for support. There was nothing wrong with that, except we risked isolating him and leaving him feeling resentful. Fortunately for us, things didn't turn out that way. And finally, lean on your friends and allow them to lean on you. This is just an extension of the friendship bond, but it becomes particularly important when you're working together to reach a goal, because the pact essentially ties your fates together. One of the main benefits of forming a pact with friends is that you have an automatic network of support. You shouldn't have to seek elsewhere to find it. The three of us didn't truly realize how much we had accomplished together until we started working on this book. Of course, we understood the enormity of our achievements. We can hardly believe them ourselves, but working together on this project, going over our years together, we feel great pride. And we also feel awe. Awe in the power of friendship, a power greater than any one of us could have individually. After writing this book, we see more clearly than ever that we needed each other to achieve our dreams. Even as we write, we are just weeks away from completing our residencies. Sam will be starting as an emergency room attending physician, a head doctor at Beth Israel in Newark. George will be an administrator and assistant professor at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey in Newark, and he is working on his master's in public health. Ramik will be starting as an assistant professor and director of the outpatient clinic at St. Peter's University Hospital in New Brunswick, just a few miles away. Our pact has extended beyond anything we could have ever imagined in high school. Through our nonprofit organization, the Three Doctors Foundation, we hope to inspire and create opportunities for inner city communities by providing education, mentoring, and health awareness. The foundation is a vehicle through which we do our community work. We do public speaking engagements together. We go to schools, colleges, churches, and even corporations to share our story. We've come a long way from the streets of Newark in some ways, but not that far at all in others. Our hearts are still with the families and friends who didn't have the opportunities, the friendships, or maybe even the crazy dreams that were somehow given to us. Those who are still struggling every day just to survive. They are the reason we wrote this book. Dr. Samson Davis, Dr. George Jenkins, and Dr. Ramik Hunt.
This has been a Highbridge Audio production.